to episode 210 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and joining me today on the podcast is Daniel Pine, whose Water Memory was published earlier this week. Happy belated Pub Day, and welcome to Speaking of Mysteries, Dan.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Oh, and can I call you Dan?
Yeah, Dan is fine.
As I was putting these questions together, I was torn where to start, but I was so intrigued with the title. And as I feel as though I have to start there, early in the story, while he's engaging in an act of piracy in the seas off South America, a young man suffers unspeakable burns inflicted by the pirate in chief. This character shows up later in the book. He survives, but his discovery, burned to a crisp and barely alive by locals, puts them in mind of the region's pre-Christian beliefs. And then you wrote this: dip a hand into the ocean, the old ones say, and you have at your fingertips everything you've ever done, dreamed, and everything every man or woman who has ever lived has thought or cared to remember. Water is ancient, here since the beginning of time. So the water remembers. I just found that a very interesting counterpoint to the whole story.
Yeah. It actually, you know, it was interesting. It was in the way that these things evolve. I had a different title for the book to begin with. I had that character and I had everything that went on with him, but I had a different title and I was looking for a title that talked more about memory than the title I had, because the more I worked on the book, the more it became, you know, it's a thriller. Yes, it's a potboiler. Yeah, she's a kick-ass heroine. But at her core is this idea that memory defines us. And it's a theme that I've worked with before in other books and in movies that I've written. And memory fascinates me. And I stumbled on this, it's really a homeopathic theory, because homeopathic medicine is based on, I mean, it's basically harmless solutions that claim to have healing powers based on what's in them, but there isn't enough of it in them technically to do anything. But in the homeopathic theory, the water carries a memory of the chemicals that have been in it, and that helps heal you. And I thought, just philosophically, that was such a great concept and a great way of expressing what my character was going through, which is this process of fearing that she's going to lose her memories, but also she's haunted by memories, and the memories that she has of what happened to her in the past affect the way that she operates in the present. So it was this great thing that came together. And when I found that, then I went back and I wrote that little passage about the Islanders and their beliefs.
And so that brings us to Aubrey Sentros, who you've mentioned, who is your kick-ass heroine of this. And, you know, so on to this sort of swirling liquid repository of memories goes Aubrey. And so tell us about her, because she's a unique character in many ways, and I found her extremely compelling.
Good. Yeah, it's she's, you know, I like to write, even when I'm writing something that feels genre and conventional, I like to find ways to examine the conventions and twist them and turn them and blow them apart if I can, by looking at them through a different lens. And over the years on other projects and just in research I'd done, I started to get really interested in how people who do these extreme jobs, these special forces jobs, these private military contractors, how they reintegrate into society, what their lives are like that aren't like what we see in the movies, because they aren't. And then I got interested in how the new generation of women who have grown up post Title IX, who have been a little more accepted into the military, who have been able to do jobs that are conventionally considered to be male jobs involving strength or involving, you know, violence, how they negotiate the world and what it, and how that then affects their traditional roles, because I'm always interested in that kind of dichotomy, no matter what my character is. So in the case of Aubrey, you have this woman who's been trained to do a certain thing, and she's spent, she's the primary breadwinner in her family. So she was away from her children when they were growing up. Her husband raised the children. They had a great relationship with, you know, with some caveats, but a normal relationship. But now that her children are grown and she's still a relatively young woman, she's looking back at it and wondering, did I do the right thing? What price did I pay for the decisions I've made? Do I regret them? And she goes on this journey. I took her purposefully on a journey where she thinks that's what she's going to deal with. And then she gets confronted with the very blunt instrument of her job, which is pirates try to board this cargo ship. And she kind of falls back on her default, which is to protect the passengers, to save her own life, and to thwart the threat. And much of the book is driven by that, but she keeps cycling back to these other questions as she's going through it. It tends to affect what she does as she goes.
Well, I kept thinking about the advice from well-meaning strangers. And at the beginning of the book, when you introduce us to Aubrey, she's with a doctor who's talking to her about the possibility that she has a traumatic brain injury from old concussions, and it could affect her memory.
Right.
So he's the one that suggests maybe a cruise. And I just found that really funny, because Aubrey admits in the book that she doesn't really like boats. And so there are a lot of ways for you to sort of contemplate your past and think about your future other than going on a cargo ship to South America. So, you know, this might be getting too deep into Aubrey, but, you know, was she confronting her fears or her dislikes, or just wanted something radically different? I mean, obviously she's got to go on the boat to set up the story, but I just found that very interesting.
I think she wanted something radically different. She also wanted something that was that was isolating. The premise for this, part of the premise for this started because I was on a scout with the cinematographer Tak Fujimoto, and he told me that he did this between movies. He would go on these cruises to just chill out. And what he described seemed like the perfect remedy for someone who's going through what Aubrey's going through, which is a possible career change and all these questions. And she just didn't want to be hassled. You know, she didn't just want to go to a hotel and sit. I think it was the complete blown out change of pace that appealed to her. Plus, as I say at the beginning of the book, she hasn't taken many vacations, so she's really not sure.
She's not really good at the vacation thing.
Yeah, so this seemed like it would be all taken care of. She'd have meals, she'd sit in her room, she'd sit on the deck, and she'd stare at the ocean and contemplate life.
One of those, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
At the time, yeah. And she does not have issues with, she's been on ships before, so she's doesn't have that much issue with seasickness or the things that you would normally think of, that I would think about.
But the things that she can conjure from her memory is that she doesn't really like boats.
Right.
So, you know, as someone who has attempted, you know, to do things that I'm pretty sure I don't like to do with the idea of, well, you know, maybe I'm wrong.
Right.
I'm usually not.
Well, in her context for boats is in terms of her work, experiences right. She's had with boats in the context of her work. I also felt like she's a character. She always, she is she's consistently confronting me with, she makes decisions to do things because they're right, not necessarily because she's comfortable doing them. You know, she talks about that a little bit, that she does the things that other people won't do. So there's a bit of a sort of stoic, okay, I'm going to do this now. And she just goes.
And we should explain that as you mentioned, that, you know, she's a woman, a post Title IX woman. She's her career was first as a government operative, you know, doing sort of black ops and
kind of clean up. There's different
clean up in aisle nine.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, officially, women still don't do those roles in the military. Who knows in the private sector, but they do it. I mean, yes. I've talked to women in the service, and they do those jobs. They just don't get to formally call themselves SEALs, but they do the work.
I also thought it was interesting that I know I keep going back to this visit with the doctor, but this is where I sort of found the black humor in your book. And there is quite a bit of very black humor, but he's asking her how she got this persistent post-concussion syndrome, which is possibly brought on serial traumatic brain injuries. Of course, you're not really sure until after the patient dies. But the doctor says, you know, were you in an abusive relationship or maybe soccer? She's thinking to herself, well, no, you know, my husband and I had a loving relationship and I never played soccer. But I did get the living crap kicked out of me from time to time.
Well, and where this started was I read an article somewhere. I was always interested in how these soldiers in Afghanistan and in Iraq were being exposed to IEDs and mortar fire. So they weren't getting, their heads were getting shaken, but they weren't getting a classical injury, maybe not even a diagnosable concussion, but repeated exposure to that has been discovered to be similar to what football players experience over a course of a career. You know, never an obvious concussion, but the repeated blows, the repeated trauma to the head has effects. And I just thought it would be fascinating to have that scene because, and this has become more of a thing as I've written her more fully, she's also lived a life of lies. You know, the way anyone who works in a covert field in the CIA, they have to lie to everyone, to their family, to their friends, she can't tell the doctor what she did. So that kind of interested me, where the doctor who isn't thinking in those terms, where his mind would go, you know, more conventional places.
And of course, we should say inside the CIA, which she is no longer part of, they do have physicians and medical staff where you can talk about it.
Yes.
But many CIA people do not go to those doctors because those doctors report back to the employer.
Right.
So
right. It's like HR. It's like human
resources. It's like HR. It's like, well, you know, someone came in and can't remember where they are or who they are. So she's no longer with the CIA, but, you know, she goes to this outside doctor and she doesn't even trust HIPAA, which was probably wise of her.
She has a job now in private security and she doesn't want them to know that she's possibly suffering something because that will impact her present job.
So the other touch that you had that I thought was really nice was, you know, she thinks she's going to read on this Ship of Fools. So she brings Conrad's Lord Jim, a book that her newfound friend on the boat points out no one willingly reads. And so I thought, is there a significance to Conrad specifically, other than Lord Jim is a book about a sailor maybe that one of Conrad's other books is The Secret Agent.
Yes, yes. You know, he was one of my inspirations for this. The Ship of Fools was another one, Catherine M. Porter's book. But yeah, The Secret Agent.
Heart of Darkness.
Heart of Darkness. It's a little bit heavy-handed, but I love the kind of symmetry of her reading a sea adventure. I also have this, I do have this feeling and or this theory that a lot of classical books are thrillers. And, you know, the purgative of a thriller, modern thriller, is, oh, it's, you know, it's light, it's it has no depth to it. But the motor of a thriller goes back to the beginning of literature, to Homer. And we just don't think of that very often. A lot of the great stories that I like are thrillers. So,
well, I think that brings us to this sort of age-old conversation about genre, which is, when I've talked to other writers about it, has gone from, you know, I don't like to be considered a genre writer, I'm a writer, to genre can be good for categorizing. Like, I'd like to read a book about spies, so I'm going to go to the spy thriller section of hopefully your independent bookstore, but maybe Amazon. I agree with you, and I think your book is as much about a person's journey as being confronted with a ship full of pirates.
Right, right. The downside of the trap of genre is you do have readers who want a certain thing, and if you don't deliver that thing, they're disappointed, and I get that. And so for a writer like me, I like to use the genre as a jumping off point to help sort of organize the story, to give it a familiar feel, and then go from there. I mean, John le Carré wrote great literature, but they were spy stories. Or Graham Greene, who wrote these kinds of stories, but they were so much more. They were about people and places and conflicts.
And resolution, which were never, at least in Graham Greene's and in le Carré's to a certain extent, never really satisfactory to the main character.
No.
To the reader, but not to the main character.
Yeah, they never quite get where they need, what they need.
So, you know, so she's surrounded by these swirling memories, and she's on this boat, and bad men have come onto this boat, and they are shooting guns and they're killing people. She's having trouble with actual memory, like, you know, what kind of gun is that? And who was that person again? And excuse me, who was that professor I had at Quantico? But the other kind of memory kicks in with her, and that is her muscle memory. And right. So it's sort of like lizard brain. You know, she's knows what to do without using that part of her cognitive mind. And I also found that interesting because a lot of what we do in our day-to-day life, maybe not writing, hopefully, is by rote.
Right.
You get in the car, you put you start the car, whether you're using a key or, you know, you just push a button, you start the car, you drive, and it's become lizard brain. And that's kind of what she does. And she sort of says to somebody at one point, this is what how do you know how to do this stuff? Well, this is what I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought that was another kind of memory that this book was talking about.
We should say that her memory loss, she is recovering from a concussion as the book starts. So a lot of what she's suffering is the aftershocks of that. So a lot of the short-term memory loss has to do with that in the short. And then she has a couple other blows to the head as she goes along, which are not good. But what fascinates me as I dig into this is how little they still know about this field. I mean, some football players are affected and some aren't. All of them seem to have it, but how it manifests itself is different depending upon who it is. Some people can have one concussion and it can put them out of commission forever. And some people can have many and it doesn't seem to have the same effect. So it gave me a lot of sort of literary leeway with her. So it didn't have to necessarily progress. It just had to be a frustration and an impediment to getting done what she needed to get done.
And you touched on this earlier. This is also a story of family. Aubrey is now a widow, and you know her marriage was loving but conflicted. And the relationship, she has two children, and the relationship with her children is complicated, to say the least, because of a lifetime of lies and absence, and ultimately surprising. So, you know, as a parent of an adult child, I always think, did she really know what I was doing? Or, you know, or was she, you know, and I was not a spy. Did she know or did she care? Did she just want mom? I wanted you to talk a little bit about that and the character and the relationship to the story and how she feels about people.
Yeah, I have two adult children, and I was surprised as they became adults at what they thought I did, at how they viewed my job. They really didn't, you know, I was in Hollywood, but I wasn't steeped in Hollywood social life. So they really weren't aware of what I did. They thought, you know, like I wrote movies. They never watched them. They didn't really think about it. I think they just thought of me, I'm around and I coach soccer and I spent time with them and I read a lot of books. And then as adults, as they're looking at me, they, you know, all these surprises pop up for them. Like I'd been hiding things. I was interested in that. I was thinking, what would it have been like? I had children later, but a lot of these people, a lot of military families start early. And in Aubrey's case, she has her son before she even joins the military. She joins it for the healthcare and the regular income. But if you have children at 18 and 20, they're grown when you're 40.
Yeah.
Which I thought that would be really different. That would be a lot different. And your relationship with them would be different because of that. But yeah, there were so many things swirling in this story. It was really fun to write it. It was a challenge.
It was mostly fun to read it. Although there were some, you know, the young man who sustains the injuries, that was pretty gross. We won't go into it, but it was, you know, and the doctor he eventually sees, made me think of people that step off the path.
Right.
What?
Yeah, it owes a lot. I mean, I owe a lot to so many writers who have been down this road. But I've known people like that too. I've known people who have joined the Peace Corps who just drop out and get lost. And it was fun in the movie version of this. If this were a screenplay, I couldn't do as much of that. You'd kind of touch on it. You'd have Luke Wilson playing that guy or Owen Wilson playing that guy. So you'd have that moment of sort of distraction, but in general, you'd stay focused on the action and you don't get a chance to like let the story breathe. So it was fun to be able to do that.
Well, like all good writers and journalists, you have anticipated my next question. that your path to writing fiction has not been a straight line. Most of us who write, our path has not been a straight line. But you're a successful screenwriter, and I'm endlessly fascinated by what I call, what I really want to do is write a crime fiction novel. So Water Memory is your fourth novel. So, I mean, it's, this is not your first time down this primrose path. But I want to ask you, and this is might be the last question, but I might have another one. Can you tell us about your path to writing crime fiction? What was your, but I really, what I really want to do is write a crime fiction novel moment?
I kind of started there. I have to say that I started out as a young writer thinking I would write short stories and novels. And I was kind of intrigued by genre fiction, Le Carre even then, and Raymond Chandler, of course, and Ross MacDonald and Dashiell Hammett. So I was kind of, you know, I had those literary pretensions, but I also was kind of fascinated by the vitality of crime fiction of the 40s, that sort of, it just, there was a life to it. And I got sort of, for want of a better word, I just wasn't good enough at it. I got very precious. I couldn't quite break through. And then at the same time, I had a kind of interest in dramatic fiction, in plays and movies. And by chance, I got into film school at UCLA, and I didn't know anything about the movie business. I didn't know anyone. And I met a couple people. I had a mentor who was really good. And I really started to love writing screenplays because they're, for me, they're like poetry. They're so concise. And having to learn the art of how to describe something in as few words, not even sentences, but as few words as possible in the most provocative way to inspire someone to make a movie was a great thing. And on top of that, no one really cares in the movie business how you write your script, what the prose is. So it gave me a lot of chance to experiment and find my voice. And when I came back to fiction, I kept writing fiction, but there was a point at which I said, I have to just let go of the difference between the two. And I have to take what I've learned as a screenwriter and that voice that I've established as a screenwriter and try to bring it back and use it in prose. And that was when everything started to click a little bit. It still took a while. And I was writing, you know, nights and weekends and when I could.
Well, I think that's the thing about writing is it always weaves together so much of what you've done in the past, and screenwriting and playwriting, I think specifically helps with dialogue.
Yeah. But I find it, you know, it was interesting. I read a lot of books that were being considered for adaptations or would be sent to me to see if I wanted to adapt them. And I was always frustrated because a lot of times the manuscripts that I'd read felt like just auditions for movies. They didn't feel like real books. They felt like treatments for screenplays. And I thought, this is wrong. The books should be books and then you adapt them. And I purposefully didn't want to become one of those writers who makes the transition and just writes long, you know, dialogue chapters, a little bit of description and a lot of dialogue, which is a style and it's not horrible, but I had to focus on, okay, how do I get inside of people? How do I describe what they're thinking? And how do I use my prose, my language in a way that I can't in a film, you know, but do the same things that the film does for me. And it's been, you know, it's a slow learning process, but I feel like I get better with each project. So far, so good.
Well, absolutely. And I was thinking you are still a working screenwriter. You worked on Bosch, which has just wrapped up its last season, I believe.
Right.
And so it's a two-part question. What is your next screenwriting project? And what is your next literary, not to say screenplays aren't literature, but what is your next bookish project?
I don't really have a screenwriting project because I left Bosch to finish this book and to do a pilot for Showtime that has gone into turnaround, unfortunately. An adaptation of The Grifters, actually, the Jim Thompson novel. So I was working on this, and then as I was finishing this, I had another novel that I was working on that I was almost done with. And Amazon asked if I had a sequel to Water Memory. And I said, well, sort of. So I told them what I was doing and they said, oh, that's great. Can you deliver it by December? And I said, no. So I stopped what I was working on and I started working on a second Aubrey Centro book, which I've never done. I mean, I've done serialized characters, obviously on television, but I've never actually done a book and then even thought about, well, would I write another book about this person? So we'll see. I mean, I'm almost done, but it's much different going back the second time. I don't want to do what I did in the first book at all. I don't just want to write the same book again. So I've had to take her to other places, but it turned out there was a lot that I didn't get in. So there's a lot still in her past. And I was sort of inspired by Philip Kerr because he writes his books out of order. Mm-hmm. And he just fills in details on his protagonist. And I found that fascinating and kind of inspiring.
I was going to ask you if we were going to see Aubrey Centro again. So once again, you anticipated my last question. I can see that there would be a lot in her character and in her story that make us want to catch up with her.
Yeah, there's more. There was actually a piece that I trimmed out. That's just referenced briefly in the novel about something bad that went on in Berlin at the very beginning of her career when she was a young woman. So I used that as my jumping off point, explaining what that was and how that's now playing out. It starts to play out in present day. So it's a little bit prequel, sequel.
Well, that gives us something to look forward to. Thanks, Dan, for talking to us about Water Memory and about Aubrey Centro and about the process and what we have to look forward to in the future. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. This is a great interview.